Hello, this is Al Reynolds from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated December 16th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Today's edition, top of the fold, first article is entitled RBC Setting Up Customer Operation Here by Amanda Jones Hoyle from Raleigh. Royal Bank of Canada has chosen Raleigh as the location for a new banking platform to serve its customers in the U.S. and has lined up space that could accommodate as many as 125 workers. The news will come as a balm to community leaders fretful about the loss of Royal Bank's U.S. retailing banking operation, which is headquartered in Raleigh but is in the process of being acquired by Pittsburgh PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated, which is led by CEO James Rohrer. RBC has signed a lease for 43,278 square feet of office space in the Briar Creek Corporate Center Office Park in Raleigh that will serve as the headquarters of the new banking operation, bank and real estate sources confirm. The majority of the sales force will be in Florida. Bank officials would not confirm the number of employees required of the operation. Royal Bank of Canada, in June, agreed to sell RBC Bank USA for $3.4 million to PNC. Among the assets being sold to PNC are RBC Bank's 424 branches in North Carolina and in five other southeastern states, as well as the bank's corporate headquarters operations in Raleigh. The sale agreement with PNC did not include any of RBC Bank's cross-border client accounts, nor did it include Royal Bank of Canada's wealth management services and capital markets operations in the U.S. In order to continue servicing those clients, RBC plans to launch the new platform in mid-February, pending regulatory approval. RBC plans to use the existing charter for RBC Bank Georgia NA to launch the new platform that will be based in Raleigh, says Dorsey Tobias, a spokeswoman for RBC Bank in Raleigh. The RBC Bank Georgia entity will allow RBC's Canadian customers to continue transferring funds between their U.S. and Canadian bank accounts after they have been issued new checks, debit cards, and credit cards. PNC plans to convert RBC Bank USA customers to the PNC platform as soon as the acquisition is finalized, which is expected to happen in March. PNC also has agreed to buy $165 million in credit card assets of RBC's wholly owned subsidiary, RBC Bank Georgia National Association, which is a chartered bank based in Atlanta with six employees and $259 million in assets, according to FDIC. At Briar Creek, RBC will move into an office space that was previously the headquarters for Inspire Pharmaceuticals, a Raleigh-based research and development firm that was acquired by pharmaceutical giant Merck in August. Merck closed Inspire's Raleigh headquarters in the 8081 Arco Corporate Drive building at Briar Creek Corporate Center in August and hired the Jones Lang LaSalle commercial real estate firm to market the space for sublease for the remainder of the lease term. Merck's lease for the Inspire office space extends through the end of 2017, says Michael Morgan of Jones Lang LaSalle in Raleigh. CBRE real estate brokers Joel Walker and John Daly and Jason High at the Raleigh CBRE office represented RBC Bank in the lease negotiations. Next up, 510 Glenwood owner ceases loan payments by Amanda Jones Hoyle from Raleigh. The owner of the 510 Glenwood building, anchoring downtown Raleigh's Glenwood South District, has fallen behind in making the building's mortgage payments. While the building is not in foreclosure, a red flag was raised in early October when the building's $12.9 million commercial mortgage-backed securities loan was transferred to a special servicer hired to manage the loan. The 510 Glenwood loan has a balance of $11.5 million, according to data from CMBS analysis firm TREP LLC. No loan payments have been made since August, TREP data shows. The loan covers the building's 67,369 square feet of office and retail space, but it does not include 36 residential condo units or the building's parking deck. Neil Coker, managing member of Berkham Capital II, LLC, which owns the commercial space in the building, says his group is negotiating to extend the mortgage. "We're not going to be foreclosed," Coker says, but he declined to elaborate on the status of the negotiations. Built in 2000, the 510 Glenwood building, along with the redevelopment of the Creamery building in 1999, has been credited as a catalyst for the birth of the Glenwood South District. Glenwood South is now considered one of the city's most dynamic areas for restaurants and nightlife. Coker built the building with backing from several investors, including Warner Brothers Entertainment president and COO Alan Horn. The project was deemed a huge success after attracting corporate tenants including the Morgan Keegan Stock Brokerage Company, the offices of J. Davis Architects, and three restaurants. CW Capital Asset Management of Washington, D.C., one of the largest special servicers in the industry, has been assigned to the 510 Glenwood loan, but CW Capital spokeswoman Beth Orcutt says the company cannot discuss details of any loan arrangements. According to Trepp, the loan file is being reviewed to determine a workout strategy going forward. "At this point, all roads lead through the special servicer," explains Bob Holkel, Senior Vice President of Grand Bridge Real Estate Capital, which works with investors seeking commercial mortgage loans. Huckle says he has no insider knowledge of the loan arrangement for 510 Glenwood, but he notes that in delinquent loan situations, a borrower has to prove he can still add value to the building. "If the special servicer feels that the borrower is the best road to recovery, then he's going to stay with them," he says. The 510 Glenwood building's office and retail has been 87% occupied or better since 2001, but the occupancy rate plummeted to around 65% in February after a restaurant closed and Morgan Keegan vacated the property and allowed its lease to expire at the end of 2010. Since then, the Allen Penix Law Firm and Knowledge Tree have backfilled most of the old Morgan Keegan office space, and the Cantina South restaurant opened in the old Bogart space in July. J. Davis Architects still leases about 15,300 square feet in the 510 Glenwood building, but the firm founder, Jeff Davis, notes the firm has in recent years subleased some of its space to other tenants due to downsizing of his company. "I think we gave up about 5,000 square feet, but now we're busting at the seams," he says. "We're back to the space we had in 2001. Still on the front page, bottom of the fold, a French connection. BioMérieux doubles output at Durham Medical Products Plant. By Jason DeBrun from Raleigh. Quietly, one of the area's largest international concerns, French medical device manufacturer BioMérieux completed a $30 million expansion of its production line in December, giving it the ability to more than double its output. The Durham company had been at full capacity, company officials say, and hardly able to keep up with orders even at three shifts per day, 6 days per week. The expanded line will allow the plant to add to its current roster of 650 employees, but site manager Brian Riley says no firm hiring goals have been set yet. BioMérieux produces in vitro diagnostic products to sell around the world. In 2010, company revenue hit $1.8 billion, with 87% of sales outside of France. "Revenue will be around $2 billion this year," estimates Riley, with more than 50% coming from the clinical microbiology unit that calls Durham its North American headquarters. In essence, BioMérieux's Durham unit, along with the company's other U.S. operations in Chicago and St. Louis, are playing a critical role in the company's growth. Put simply, the company helps doctors and hospital labs test for blood-borne diseases. A doctor will draw blood from a patient suspected to have a blood infection and mix it with BioMérieux's liquid product in a tube with a colored sensor on the bottom. A separate BioMérieux instrument will monitor the tube and record changes in the sensor color, thereby diagnosing bacteria in the blood. It can then give a recommendation for treatment, bringing precision and speed to a process that used to take days, says Grover Smith, Executive Director of Pathology at WakeMed Health and Hospitals. Primary uses are in clinical settings, which make up about 85% of BioMérieux's shipments, says Michael Springer, Senior Manager of Manufacturing. The American Red Cross, which tests donated blood before distributing, is another customer. This product is a critically important part of our testing processes to ensure each platelet donation is as safe as possible and of the highest possible quality before transfusion to someone in need, says Stephanie Milan, American Red Cross's Director of Biomedical Communications. BioMérieux's product comes in plastic tube containers with production reaching 85 million bottles per year, or roughly 190 per minute, at its 231,000 square foot manufacturing facility north of Durham in Trayburn Corporate Park, next to drug manufacturer Merck & Company. The expanded production line performs roughly the same operation, only better, Springer says, comparing it to a next-generation computer. The mixing and bottling equipment takes up relatively little space, and BioMérieux did not have to go through a footprint expansion. An unused section of the existing facility was gutted and rebuilt to fit the new equipment, which, from the outside, looks much like a stainless steel soda bottling machine. In fact, Springer says BioMérieux runs into some of the same problems as a bottling company. Naturally, it has other and different concerns as well, but when machines are running at full capacity, visible through large windows inside the facility, it looks similar to a bottling company with equipment not much larger than an industrial kitchen equipment. There was little construction cost. Nearly the full $30 million expansion went to the new production line, and there is an additional $10 million investment anticipated by 2015. Specifics about the equipment were not released. It's a busy, exciting time, says Riley. We're struggling to keep up with growth. Founded in 1897 by Marcel Mérieux as Institut Mérieux, BioMérieux has worked with vaccines and biological products for decades. In fact, Marcel Mérieux studied biology under Louis Pasteur, the biologist whose discoveries helped eradicate many diseases and who developed pasteurization, the process to protect milk from harmful bacteria. Moving to the inside of this week's edition, Utilities Sticking to Guns and FERC Showdown by John Downey. From Charlotte, Duke Energy Corporation's response to a federal regulator's ruling against the merger with Progress Energy Incorporated will almost certainly involve modifying its virtual divestiture proposal rather than attempting more drastic measures. Duke CEO Jim Rogers in November acknowledged the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission might reject Duke's proposal, but he said the virtual divestiture track, in which specified amounts of power are reserved for sale in wholesale markets at times of peak demand to ensure competitive pricing, would have to be the basis for negotiations. The FERC decision means the proposed $26 billion merger cannot be completed before the end of the year, and it raises the possibility that stronger measures might be required to address the wholesale power issue that could be rejected by state regulators. The development is of interest to Raleigh software company Red Hat, which has agreed to sublease space in Progress Energy's 365,000-square-foot building at the corner of Wilmington and Davies Street in downtown Raleigh. Red Hat Chief Financial Officer Charlie Peters downplayed the regulatory development, saying he has a lot of confidence the merger will be completed. "We don't have any concerns about it, really," says Peters, who adds that the company is prepared in case there are any further complications. "We do have a Plan B," he says, but declined to provide details. Peters says Red Hat has planned its move to downtown Raleigh in mid-year 2012, and the process would take at least 6 months. The software firm has about 800 employees in Raleigh. The virtual divestiture Duke and Progress proposed was among the possible solutions FERC suggested when it issued its conditional approval on September 30th. Other possible solutions the FERC suggested include, 1, having Duke join a regional transmission organization, which the state utility customer advocates in both Carolinas oppose and which would be a hard sell to state regulators in North Carolina, who haven't yet approved the merger. 2. Requiring the sale of a significant portion of the post-merger Duke's non-nuclear power plant capacity. Duke and Progress have said they need to hold on to that capacity to meet customer demand for power. In November, at least Rogers saw those solutions as off the table. Continuing, we're not going to join an RTO regional transmission organization. North Carolina wouldn't like it or let us, he said in a November 13th interview with the Charlotte Business Journal. I think the idea of divesting 800 megawatts is a non-starter for the company, and neither state commission is going to support spinning off 800 megawatts because we need it to meet our load. He said that if the FERC rejected Duke and Progress's initial proposal, as it did in a ruling on the evening of December 14th, he expected the negotiations for a solution would center on altering the virtual divestiture proposals rather than considering alternatives. The commission says Duke and Progress have not demonstrated that their proposal will address the issues raised by FERC's analysis. It says in its reading of the evidence presented by Duke and Progress, the proposal would, quote, fail to adequately mitigate the market power, end quote, issues because the companies do not propose to relinquish control of power they offer to sell. And the commission finds that the plan doesn't provide sufficient independent oversight of Duke's compliance with its own proposal. But the ruling appears to suggest ways that Duke and Progress could alter the virtual divestiture proposal to make it more acceptable. The commission is clearly concerned, for instance, that the proposal calls only for selling excess power on short notice and will not involve long-term contracts that buyers can depend on. It also says that the virtual divestitures that hand more sales authority over to third parties have been acceptable to the commission in the past. It is unclear that the ultimate impact of the ruling could be. Asked whether Duke is still confident that the merger can be accomplished, spokesman Tom Williams said simply, "We are evaluating the order and determining our next steps." Progress spokesman Mike Hughes says he has heard nothing to indicate that the merger itself is threatened by the ruling. "It's not completely clear what the issues are and what the remedy is," he says, adding, "It's a departure from what we've seen FERC do in the past." Both say altering the virtual divestiture proposal will be considered. "There are various ways to do a virtual divestiture," Williams says. "It is something Jim has talked about in the past, and we are looking at our options." The Federal Commission has approved the merger on the condition that the companies propose acceptable measures that would ensure that the post-merger Duke would not exercise dominant market power over competitive wholesale markets in the Carolinas during summer and winter periods of peak demand for power. That approval stands, but the power companies must try again to come up with an acceptable plan to make sure that the merger does not crush competition in Carolina's wholesale markets. At a minimum, the December 14th ruling seems likely to push final approval of the merger into next year and probably past the first quarter. The North Carolina Utilities Commission has yet to rule on the merger. Hughes calls the ruling surprising and frustrating. Quote, "It appears to be a departure from how FERC has traditionally viewed mergers like this," he says. "We are left wondering if the rules have changed and whether they have changed again." Dan Fogel of Wake Forest University's Center for Energy, Environment, and Sustainability says he is not surprised. He says that the FERC has a lot of leverage over Duke and Progress right now. "I think they believe they can get a whole lot more than Duke and Progress have offered so far." It is possible that a more rigorous virtual divestiture proposal would satisfy FERC, but the more Duke and Progress concede to the federal agency, the harder North Carolina regulators are likely to scrutinize the proposal, and it is possible that the power companies could have difficulty finding a solution acceptable to both sets of regulators. Patient Device Spawns Young Firm at North Carolina State University by Jason DeBruin. From Raleigh, imagine you've had a severe accident that leaves your arms, legs, and even neck temporarily immobilized. While recovering in a hospital bed, you want to contact the nurse but can't access the call button because you are immobilized. While this scenario might happen to only 15 or 20 patients per year at a large hospital, it can leave patients in stressful situations and hinder recovery, says Mindy Holt, a speech-language pathologist at WakeMed Health and Hospitals. As you can imagine, these patients are quite frightened, says Kathy Thompson, WakeMed Manager of Outpatient Rehab and Director of the Spinal Cord Injury Program. A group of graduate students at NC State University say they are developing a solution, a nurse call device activated with the forehead, and they hope to build a business around the idea. They incorporated Augment Medical Incorporated in May and hope to present a fully developed prototype of their device to hospitals next year. The device would rest on a patient's forehead and send a signal to a nurse's station when a patient raises his or her eyebrows, says Tim Martin, who is Augment's president. Nearly all patients retain the use of muscles in their forehead even if they temporarily lose functions of the lower extremities, which makes the approach viable. So far, Augment has not gone to large investors, working primarily off government grants, allowing Martin and his three partners to keep ownership of the company. They have rent-free incubator space at the Carolina Launchpad, a University of North Carolina program run through the RENCI, the Renaissance Computing Institute in Chapel Hill. The search for a technology for spinal cord injury patients to call a nurse has been a roughly two-year undertaking, says Holt. To this point, however, we didn't find options that worked for us. WakeMed has worked with a senior design class taught by Andrew DeMio at North Carolina State, a class under the Biomedical Engineering Department, a joint department with the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Years ago, an undergraduate group in that class identified the project to help patients with spinal cord injury, but graduated and did not move it forward. Holt asked DeMio about looking into the project again, and DeMio, in the middle of starting a graduate-level course in medical device innovation at the time, proposed the issue to Martin and his partner, Richard Daniels, who grabbed the bull by the horns and took off with it, says DeMio. Although it still needs finishing touches, the Augment Medical product sounds like a really great solution, says WakeMed's Holt. Because a small number of patients would need such a device, Thompson says pricing could be an issue. Initially, there was talk of the price being as high as $15,000, she says, but that's come down significantly. Ideally, Thompson would hope to pay about $1,000 per unit, though she says having the price at less than $3,000 would be doable. The hospital the size of a WakeMed could not need more than three devices, which can fit in a case as small as a briefcase. The device would plug into existing nurse call network. Classified as a medical device, the product would need approval from the U.S. Food and Drug Administration before it could be marketed. Because the device would be non-invasive, however, the approval process goes much faster than for other devices. After Martin and his team fully develop a prototype, they will look to advance their business in for the product, likely finding a business partner or hiring someone with business experience. I may be the president, but I'm an engineer, says Martin with a smile, and I've never run a company. Next up, Roasters Awaken by Chris Bagley from Durham. Roasters in the Triangle are adjusting to a dramatic rise in the wholesale coffee prices, taking a hit to their bottom lines even as revenue continues to grow at double-digit rates. Coffee has grown in popularity since the early 1990s in the United States, as evidenced by the ubiquitous Starbucks shops seemingly popping up on every corner. Roasters Counterculture Coffee Incorporated, on South Austin Avenue in Durham, and Stockton Graham & Company, off Glenwood Avenue in North Raleigh, say their sales have been growing at rates of 20% to 35% annually, with their products going to clients across the eastern United States. Counterculture employs 48 people and is on track to roast 1.3 million pounds of coffee in 2011, founder and president Brett Smith says. based on the sale price of $8 a pound, counterculture will end the year with about $10 million in sales. Coffee has taken off in the last decade in China, India, Brazil, and other countries with fast-growing economies, and demand from those consumers has pushed up prices of the raw beans. Unfavorable weather conditions of late in Colombia and other coffee-growing regions have limited the supply of the raw beans, and prices have risen by more than 50% on international commodity exchanges in the last 2 years, though they've fallen somewhat since summer into the range of $1 to $2.50 a pound. Small specialty roasters usually pay more than mass producers because they tend to buy beans in smaller batches from smaller-scale farms. Stockton Graham co-founder and CEO Jeff Vojita now says he pays $3 to $7 per pound for raw beans. The two roasters, which along with Larry Beans of Raleigh are among the two Triangle's largest, say they've been able to pass along some of the higher bean prices to clients, which include restaurants, coffee shops, and upscale grocery stores. But much of it comes out of their profit, they say. Coffee prices went up by an incredible amount, Smith says. We don't think this is just a price blip for a year. Roasters say they are responding by educating consumers on the particular traits of the various coffees, their sources, and the farmers who grow the beans. Specialty roasters and the coffee houses have long emphasized coffee's ability to connect people to one another. One remarkable aspect of coffee is how strongly demand for it rebounded from the Great Recession. While the National Coffee Association reported growth this year in most segments of the market, gourmet and specialty coffees have grown particularly strong. Revenue grew by about 10% annually in 2009 and 2010, and the first 9 months of 2011 at Starbucks, Caribou, and Peet's, all publicly traded companies that roast coffee and serve the prepared beverage, according to their regulatory filings, and all have become more profitable. Every year we keep growing, which is a good thing in this economy, says Katie Glenn, co-owner of 8th Sin Coffee on South New Hope Road in Raleigh, which will finish the year with about $250,000 in sales. Like others, though, she says she's paying $4 to $5 a pound for beans, nearly double what she paid in 2010. Carolyn Kahn, who manages coffee purchases at a Southern Season grocery store in Chapel Hill, says coffee roasters in the Triangle have become so good that she doesn't need to look elsewhere. The Triangle's heavy concentration of universities and information workers lends itself to a strong coffee culture, she says. We're really very lucky. Next up, TransEnterix raises $15 million, bringing venture capital haul to $90 million, by Chris Bagley, from Durham. TransEnterix Incorporated, a developer of laparoscopic surgical tools, has received a new round of $15 million in equity financing, bringing its total funding to about $90 million. Company representatives declined to comment on the new funding, which they disclosed December 14th in a brief filing with federal securities regulators. The offering follows a $55 million equity issue in early October 2009, which drew InterSouth Ventures of Durham, SV Life Ventures, Synergy Life Science Partners in Silicon Valley, and Quaker BioVentures of Philadelphia. TransEnterix raised $21 million in 2008. TransEnterix, which is headed by CEO Todd Pope, used that funding to launch a laparoscopic device known as SPIDER for Single Port Instrument Delivery Extended Reach. In contrast to existing laparoscopic surgery devices that require multiple incisions, SPIDER is inserted into the body through a single incision, reducing the risk of infections and other complications. Laparoscopic surgeries are procedures in which doctors view tissue through a video camera that is attached to a device that is inserted into a body. The new filing doesn't identify the investors, but says nine of them bought $14.9 million of $15 million in newly offered equity. Venture funding as high as $90 million is rare among companies that have established products that are selling, as SPIDER is, says Cindy Clark, president of Illibiti, a nonprofit group in Research Triangle Park that supports North Carolina medical technology companies. It's another testament to their success, Clark says. You don't raise any money in this environment unless you have a fantastic story to tell. Clark says funding for life science companies has been scarce in the past couple of years. That's particularly true in the market for initial public offerings, she says, possibly a reason TransEnterix is continuing to raise money through a private offering. Only one other late-stage medical technology company has raised significant funding in recent months. She says, Morrisville-based Tier Science Incorporated, which raised more than $39 million in spring 2010. TransEnterix representatives wouldn't say whether TransEnterix might be using the money for research or other operations or for investing in facilities. Next up, RTI lures Brookhaven researcher to build ag research unit. With 10 researchers already hired, nonprofits leaders see work as a major new area of focus. By Amanda Jones Hoyle. From the Research Triangle Park. RTI International is branching into a new line of business with plans to build a greenhouse research facility on its campus to support the recently launched Center for Agricultural and Environmental Biotechnology. RTI in January hired microbial research expert Niels Vanderlee away from the U.S. Department of Energy's Brookhaven National Laboratory in Upton, New York. There, Vanderlee was working on a new genomic tool to study microorganisms and working on ways to use microorganisms in pollution cleanup and in the creation of biofuels. Those are areas of study that RTI, a nonprofit research organization, had not focused on before, says RTI spokesman Patrick Gibbons. RTI is better known around the world for its global health initiatives, especially in developing countries, for its life science research in genetics and personalized medicine, and for its social and economic policy research. About 35% of the $758.7 million in revenue that RTI collected in 2010 came from grant programs and partnerships from the U.S. Agency for International Development, or USAID, making USAID RTI's largest client, according to the company's 2010 annual report. USAID is already heavily involved in agricultural development research internationally, but that was one area of study that RTI had not previously been involved in, Gibbons says. We have extremely high hopes for this center, he says. Vanderlee's group, which has already grown to 10 researchers, with plans to hire 10 more in the next couple of months, will be focused on research involving microorganisms and food crops related to food safety and security issues, the role that microorganisms play in the growth of medicinal plants like ginseng, the production of biofuels using feedstock, and environmental mediation and land management. Neither Vanderlee nor Gibbons would discuss the center's working budget, but they noted that RTI will solicit research grants and funds from U.S. government agencies, commercial groups, and from international agencies to help fund the research. We hope to have 25 to 30 people by the time the greenhouse is open, and hope to eventually have over 100 people, Vanderlee says. We see this as a major focus area for RTI and a major area of growth. RTI plans to begin construction of the 4,000-square-foot greenhouse in early 2012, with construction completed by September. It will be designed to be expanded in the future, he says. Vanderlee says the greenhouse is needed to comply with government permit requirements that will allow RTI to import live plants and soils from countries around the world for its research. The center, however, will not be conducting research with pathogenic organisms or with genetically modified crops, he says. Because of the permit we have to play it safe with what we have on site. The planned RTI campus greenhouse will be small compared to at least four other greenhouses that are planned to have recently opened at other tenant companies in RTP. Syngenta, Bayer Crop Science, and BASF have already expansive greenhouse facilities on their campuses in RTP, says Corey Lyles, a planner with Research Triangle Foundation's Planning and Business Development Department, and Medicago recently completed construction of its greenhouse. Alexandria Real Estate Equities, Syngenta, and Bayer Crop Science have also announced in recent months plan to invest millions of dollars more in their greenhouse structures and RTP. We're trying to promote ag bio companies, and it seems to be gaining traction as an industry to watch, Lyle says. Continuing on, nutrition stores multiplying as more pursue healthy lives. By Jason DeBruin from Raleigh. For those who shop for nutritional supplements might remember the name Philip Cook. In 1992, he brought the first GNC stores to the Triangle and expanded to 6 locations before selling and getting out of the business. Now he's back, but not with GNC. Cook obtained franchise rights with a company called NutriShop and opened his first Triangle store in November. He's looking for sites for 2 more. Each store cost him a $15,000 licensing fee. He's not the only person to jump into the nutritional space. Vince Belay, a newcomer to the Triangle, opened 3 Complete Nutrition franchise locations in the Triangle, the most recent in August. Both men are competing in a market already flush with such stores. GNC, for example, has more than 30 locations in the Triangle. Still, both say they can succeed in part because they take a slightly different service approach and partly because of the growth of the market. In 2010, sales of sports nutrition and weight loss products totaled $22.7 billion nationally, according to a report published in May by the Nutrition Business Journal. Energy drinks and shots make up the bulk of that $12 billion, but Belay and Cook say there is enough of a market to share. I think there is room for all of us, Cook says. Brick-and-mortar nutrition stores also compete against online retailers. Patrick Richardson, a competition bodybuilder, operates All Pro Nutrition in the Duralee Corners Shopping Center. He says some of the customers will absorb advice offered by him or his staff, then shop for suggested supplements online in the hope of saving some money. It's a real problem in the industry, he says. Because he is a professional bodybuilder himself, Richardson says his store attracts a serious crowd. Local Olympic competitors are some of his customers, he says, but he is also looking to serve those who are just looking to lose some weight. Complete Nutrition is a little further along than the NutriShop and has already made a 7-figure investment in the Triangle, Belay says. He and 2 partners plan to grow their visibility through increased marketing in 2012. Each store offers slightly different services. NutriShop has lines of products sold exclusively at its franchises, and Complete Nutrition puts value on having its sales force coach people through a fitness routine. At the end of the day, all operators have the same basic goal, making people healthy. NutriShop has 140 franchises nationwide and is headquartered in Southern California. Complete Nutrition is based in Nebraska, where Belay lived before relocating to the Triangle. Cook sold the last of his GNC franchises in 2006 and tried his hand in the real estate market. This was something that was different enough to get me back in, he says of NutriShop. And now, thousands of hazardous sites and little money to clean them. Environmental officials estimate a cost of $120.5 million to scrub highest priority tracks. By Lee Weisbecker. From Raleigh. The state has $136,000 available to clean up the 214 highest priority hazardous chemical spill sites across North Carolina, a job that could cost an estimated $120.5 million. The most contaminated are on a list of hazardous sites that now numbers 1,916, with about 40 of those in the Triangle. Including former landfills, the state has 2,592 identified hazardous sites. When they can, state officials enlist the aid of property and business owners or bankruptcy court settlements to help defray cleanup costs. When those sources of cash aren't available, picking up the tab for the orphaned sites is left to the state and federal governments. The job here is handled by the Waste Management Superfund section of the North Carolina Department of Environmental and Natural Resources. Of the $120.5 million estimated to be needed to clean up the most hazardous sites, North Carolina would pay 10%, or about $12 million, and the federal government would pay the rest. The numbers were included in a recent report by the State Division of Waste Management Superfund section to the General Assembly. Quote, "The fact that the unobligated cash balance is $135,806 clearly points out that the inactive Hazardous Sites Cleanup Fund is underfunded to address inactive sites remediation across the state," end quote, the documentation says. DENR spokesman Diana Keyes says she couldn't go beyond what was in the report. None of the state's 17 top orphaned cleanup sites is in the triangle. Some top priority sites, including a lot on the campus of NC State University and at groundwater site at Ward Transformer on Mount Hermon Road in Raleigh, don't fall into the orphan category because the property owners are assisting financially in the cleanup, according to the report. North Carolina isn't the only state that has hazardous sites but little money to clean them up. In a 2010 survey, says Victoria Phillips of the Washington, D.C.-based Environmental Council of the States, half the U.S. states reported they had slashed enforcement staffs in the area, and 20 said they'd eliminated land, air, and water programs in the face of shrinking budgets. Asked to comment, officials at the Raleigh-based North Carolina Conservation Network, including General Counsel Dan Conrad and Policy Director Grady McCauley, said they couldn't comment until they had read the DENR report. For the most part, 2,592 hazardous sites were once the locations of gasoline stations, manufacturing establishments, dry cleaning companies, recyclers, and others where petroleum products and industrial chemicals, metals, pesticides, and other substances were spilled or allowed to leach into the soil. Among the triangle sites are the UNC Chapel Hill Cogeneration Electric Facility, Carmel Mall in Carrboro, International Paper on Wilmington Street in Raleigh, Daughtry Chemical on Walker Street in Durham, DeHaven on Airport Boulevard in Morrisville, and Gulf Mills Plant on Dickens Road in Fuquay Arena. Modern-day gold rush emerging in Carolina Slate Belt. By Matt Devins, from Asheboro. They say the ones who really struck it rich in the California gold rush of the 19th century weren't the guys who dug for gold, but rather it was the guys who sold them the shovels. If that's the case, the Triad may be a good place to set up a shovel shop. Modern-day prospectors are showing renewed interest in the gold of the Carolina Slate Belt that runs through the region into Virginia and South Carolina, and they're starting to get serious about it. The high price of gold has really sparked a lot of exploration all over the world, but the Carolinas have a rich history in gold mining, and it's almost been a forgotten area, says Katie Lucas, a senior project geologist with the Canadian firm Revolution Resources, which has been doing surface explorations on around 7,000 acres of Randolph and Davidson counties since last fall. But people are starting to look and realize there's a lot of potential. California's gold rush looms larger in history, but North Carolina had it beat by a good 50 years. After a 12-year-old boy found a 17-pound gold nugget in a creek on his family farm in Cabarrus County in 1799, hopeful prospectors descended by the thousands from Europe and elsewhere, setting up steam-powered stamp mills to extract gold ore. That steam technology later fueled the state's massive textile industry. They got all the easy stuff, and once it started to cost more to get at what was left than it could be sold for on the open market, the prospectors moved west, and the rush died out. Only recently, with prices rising as high as $1,900 per ounce, has a new generation of miners backed by venture capitalists and stockholders returned. Besides Revolution Resources, Other firms that have disclosed gold exploration in the region include Romarco, Aaron Ventures, and Strongbow Exploration. They're making good use of the region's gold-rich history, says Ken Taylor, chief of the North Carolina Geological Survey, focusing on areas where gold was found in the past in the hope that modern technology will bring more to the surface. Taylor says mining companies generally will pay landowners for permission to do some test drilling and then later negotiate to buy property that looks to have the strongest potential. But Taylor says he can't say exactly how much interest has peaked of late because the state doesn't require any specific permits for gold mining beyond other forms of mineral extraction, and it doesn't collect any royalties on it. The project along the Carolina Slate Belt that is furthest along is Romarco's Haley Gold Mine near Kershaw, South Carolina, which is in the permitting and environmental impact study stage and may be producing gold bars by 2014. According to a recent report by Reuters, Romarco has more than 100 employees at Haley now and expects to grow to as many as 800. The company has invested about $350 million in the project and expects to spend up to about $650 million by the time production begins. David Thomas, the vice president and general manager of the mine, wrote in an email that the company is spending about $1 million per month in South Carolina, and 83% of its workers are from the immediate area. Revolution Resources isn't as far along in its exploration in the Triad, says Lucas, that company's senior geologist who is working from Asheboro. But she has 7 full-time employees, where including a local geologist, and the company is using local firms for supplies, reclamation, and other tasks. How big that presence grows and over what amount of time depends entirely on the results of the exploration, which she says has been quite successful so far, though she declined to elaborate. But mines have a lifespan, and if a boom does come to a bust, we'll likely follow at some point. That's a concern for environmentalists such as D.J. Gergen, senior attorney at the Southern Environmental Law Center in Asheville, which has taken note of the increased interest in gold mining in the state. There is definitely a place for the gold mining industry in North Carolina, he says, as long as companies choose appropriate locations and are careful with the chemical leaching processes used by modern mines. He says he's not aware of any significant problems that have arisen so far. Quote, one concern I do have is that this resurging interest in mining is really driven by the high market price for gold, which could evaporate just as quickly as if the market price drops, he says, and quote, that opens a possibility we'll be left with open scars on the land and no responsible parties still around to do the remediation. And now it's time for a better world. News about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. From the Philanthropy News Desk of Todd Cohen. Rural giving tied to economic growth. Born and raised in rural Jones County, one of North Carolina's poorest counties, Chris Meadows opted after college to stay rather than join the exodus of young adults from the county. Now, as principal of Jones Senior High School in Trenton, Meadows wants to inspire young people to remain and give them tools to succeed. Partnering with the North Carolina Rural Center, the Jones County affiliate of the North Carolina Community Foundation aims to raise $10,000 for an endowment to support an entrepreneurial program at the high school. If we get our kids to come back and start a business and be successful, they will start a cycle of transferring wealth from one generation to the next and keep the wealth here instead of going out of state or out of the country, Meadows says. The Jones County Initiative is part of a larger effort by the Rural Center and the North Carolina Community Foundation and their counterparts in states throughout the U.S. to reverse the flow of wealth and residents from rural counties. Throughout rural America, kids are leaving because there aren't any jobs, says Jason Gray, Director of Research and Innovation at the Rural Center. Homegrown philanthropy can and should be a resource to plug into targeted community economic development work that makes these communities a place where their children can stay. Over the last 2 decades, while the state population under 18 grew 22% and the population aged 24 to 30 grew 5%, 22 rural counties lost population under the age 18, and 54 rural counties lost those aged 24 to 30, including 15 counties that lost over 20% of that age group. The Jones County Initiative has the goals of inspiring students to launch local businesses and inspiring donors to invest in endowment funds to boost the local economy while retaining philanthropic assets in the community. Beth Boney Jenkins, Vice President for the Development of the North Carolina Community Foundation, says a local couple has pledged to give $1,000 to create the new Jones County Fund if the foundation's local affiliate can raise $10,000. Rural development philanthropy, she says, involves bringing people in rural communities together to teach them how to use philanthropy to raise local dollars to address their own needs. Sally McGillery, Director of Community Leadership at the North Carolina Community Foundation, says the Jones County Initiative can serve as a model for other rural counties, each of which can identify and address its own needs, such as inspiring and promoting philanthropy over the long haul to address local needs. Gray says the Jones County Initiative is part of a larger effort by the Rural Center to help rural communities retain and support youth and other young adults. Meadows says a key goal of the Entrepreneurial Fund will be to showcase the potential of staying and working in the county. That's one of our biggest challenges, he says. We just have to show kids there's a lot we can do in Jones County if we decide to stay here. And now the guest opinion from Mr. John Bowser. Mr. Bowser is head of strategy and development for Orr Associates Incorporated in Washington, D.C. For nonprofits, planning is the key. Nonprofit organizations are struggling to adapt to the rapidly changing economic environment. As a result, many nonprofits have canceled or postponed their strategic planning just when it would benefit them the most. When nonprofits postpone their planning sessions, they lose out on the direct benefits a strategic plan affords: improved focus, increased efficiency, and better alignment of resources. They also lose indirect benefits: increased fundraising, improved government, better leadership development, and stronger succession planning. Strategic planning became popular in the 1960s and was quickly adopted by a broad cross-section of the corporate sector. It began to fall out of favor among business leaders in the 1980s, just as the nonprofit sector began to adopt it. Strategic planning waned in the corporate community because it came to be viewed as an inflexible and time-consuming process that did not effectively address the rapidly evolving social and economic environment. New approaches to strategic planning have evolved that recognize and address these shortfalls. As a result, strategic planning is once again seen as an essential element of an organization's long-term success. These new approaches, including the balanced scorecard process and real-time strategic planning mechanism, share three common characteristics. They emphasize an organization's vision as an essential driving force in the planning process. They encourage and promote strategic thinking. They recognize that strategic planning is an ongoing process. In addition to adopting more innovative processes, the business sector is refining its approach to strategic planning in other ways that can and should resonate in the nonprofit community. In a study first published in the McKinsey Quarterly in April 2009, a vast majority of those surveyed, 81%, said their approach to strategic planning had changed from the previous year. When asked how, the respondents most often cited the following: 1. More rigorous approval processes for projects. 2. More fluid, dynamic planning structure. 3. Conducting more and different analysis. 4. Planning for a shorter time frame. And 5. More regular, careful scrutiny of the environment. When asked how frequently companies assess progress against their strategic plan, 80% said they reviewed their plan at least quarterly, and half assessed programs at least monthly. Executives expressed concern that the current crisis atmosphere might undermine their organization's ability to stay focused on all but the immediate future. More than 50% said they were struggling to maintain the right balance between near-term challenges and long-term strategic priorities. This is just the kind of tension that cutting-edge approaches to strategic planning are designed to reconcile. The McKinsey survey concluded with three strategic planning tips that are essential to the nonprofit sector. 1. Be realistic about scenario-based planning. Organizations should consider multiple scenarios given the uncertain current environment. 2. Key metrics, especially leading indicators, need to be more closely monitored. Organizations should be prepared to adjust in real time to any changes in those metrics. And 3. Organizations should look beyond the crisis. Fundamental market and demographic-based trends will continue unabated and should not be ignored. Just in time for the holiday season, the Art Center's East End Gallery in Carrboro has opened its doors to local artists and crafters looking to sell their wares. The gallery has set up a pop-up store that will feature handmade and vintage clothing, jewelry, accessories, home goods, and other gifts. Featured items include products from local artists affiliated with Miscusi Handmade, Reciprocities, and River Basin Outfitters. In addition, the artists of the East End Holiday Craft Shop are hosting multiple craft nights and parties throughout December to encourage the community to support local artists while they shop for the holidays. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the Triangle Business Journal will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The web address is www.triangleReadingService.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.